sometimes I'm a little kid, and little kids love to see their dreams come true. And who hasn't wanted to sit with an astronaut and talk about what it's like to go into outer space? Well, I got to do that this year. I spoke to former NASA astronaut Dr. Don Thomas, who was in South Africa for a series of public talks and school visits. He was in NASA for 7 years and went up into space, saw the Earth from further away than any human being ever has. And he got to tell us what it's like to enter the atmosphere again, what it looks like, what it sounds like, what it feels like. And if you can't live vicariously through this astronaut, you might just be one of the few people who in the 21st century gets to live it for yourself. But if that doesn't happen, this is the next best thing. Here he is, spaceman, Dr. Don Thomas. CliffCentral.com. Every now and then you get someone to pop by the studio who's done amazing things. And we've certainly met our fair share of amazing people, but this morning is kind of exciting for me because this is like every little boy's dream, and this guy has lived that dream, and he continues to do amazing things in his life and with the stories that he has to tell. I'm talking about Dr. Donald Thomas, who is the former NASA astronaut, scientist, a professional speaker and educator and author, and he's in South Africa at the moment to regale us with all kinds of stories about what it's like to be in space. An actual astronaut. He's sitting right opposite me in his NASA uniform. Sir, it is a pleasure to see you.
It's great to be here today. Thanks for having me on.
Wow. I still can't get over the fact that you've spent, what is it, over 1,000 hours in space?
It's about almost 44 days in space during my four space shuttle missions. Yeah, orbited the Earth 692 times. So I had seen Joburg many times from space, but this is actually my first visit here, you know, down on the surface.
What an incredible thing to be able to say you've done.
It's pretty awesome to fly around, fly in one space shuttle mission is incredible experience. And I had the opportunity to do it four times. So it's just mind blowing.
You must be one of the people that they really relied on at the time if they put you up there four times, right?
They rely on all of us. I mean, there were 100 astronauts at the time, roughly, in the astronaut office there at NASA.
Did they cycle people?
And they cycle you through.
Okay. All right. So everybody gets a fair chance.
Everybody gets a fair chance.
If you're up there and you're doing good work, they keep you coming.
That's correct. If you don't do good work, you won't be going back up.
Now, you've written a book called Orbit of Discovery.
Correct.
Right. That's about your STS-70 mission, which is on board the Space Shuttle Discovery.
Right.
When we talk about these things, for many of us, it's stuff that we've seen in documentaries. It's perhaps stuff that we've seen in news footage. Maybe people have Googled a couple of pictures. But when you're in there and you're on there, that's the stuff I want to get into. That's the interesting information that I'd love you to convey to all of us. But you obviously grew up like any other kid with dreams of being, I don't know, a pilot at that stage, maybe?
When I was very young, when I was 6 years old, the first American launch into space. It was May 5th, 1961. And at my primary school, they brought all the learners to our gymnasium. I sat on the floor and I watched a small black and white TV of the launch that day. And as soon as our astronaut was in space, I remember sitting there just saying, I want to do that. I was hooked at that point.
Straight away.
And, you know, the next year, John Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth. They had us watch his launch as well, and I was hooked. So always throughout my life, this was my dream to go into space. It was a long path to get there. I was 39 when I ultimately made it to space. So it didn't happen quickly. It was a long-term dream, but I kept focused on it, and it kept me motivated and kept me inspired to keep working towards that goal.
And you were from Cleveland?
Grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, right, wow. Northern United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long way from Cape Canaveral. That's a long way from Houston.
It is. And this is a curious fact, but more humans have flown in space from the city of Cleveland than any other location on the planet Earth. And there, our joke is, you know, what is it about Cleveland that makes you want to leave the planet?
You know? Now, you said it was a long journey. But it's also a fascinating one. I mean, you did everything. You were in the technical crew for a long time. You learned to fly then. You were at the Johnson Space Center as a materials engineer. I mean, all of those things on their own would be fascinating, and all of them on their own would be an incredible career, right?
Each one was fascinating for me. I worked at a company, AT&T Bell Laboratories, doing research work on electronic devices. I worked there for 6 years, had two patents that I was able to get. But my goal was to become an astronaut, so you know, I moved down to the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, worked there as an engineer on the space shuttle program, just trying to get closer to the action, hoping that it would help in the selection process for me to become an astronaut.
Now, I mean, being a materials engineer at the Johnson Space Center, you're at the cutting edge of so much of what was being discovered, what was being implemented, what was being tried for the first time. It must have been very exhilarating, but also kind of terrifying, because a decision that you make, or a test that you conduct, or a material that you're testing, these things can have massive ramifications, you know, especially when we look at things like Challenger and all of that stuff that was happening in the 80s. There were a lot of things that the engineers were responsible for that made it an incredibly difficult job.
It's a challenging job. One of my tasks at the Johnson Space Center as an engineer was to do some analysis to see whether our pressure vessels that they were designing for the space station, would they last for 20 years? You know, they were new materials, had never been tested before. We had used them for a year or two, but the question was, will they last 20 years? And it was my job to do whatever I could to come up with an analysis to say, yes, they will last that long, or no, they won't. I gathered the data that I could find that had been published by other research, you know, organizations, and I put together a report, and I said, yeah, these things will last more than 20 years. It's been up there. The space station's been up there now for 17, 18 years, so I got two more years, and then I'll be able to say, okay.
I was right.
But I was confident that these materials will last. But that's the type of work you do. Even though sometimes we don't have all the data we need, we do projection analysis, and you kind of give your best engineering guess as to whether it's going to work or not.
When you talk about these materials lasting in space for 20 years, what are the major effects on a material in space? I mean, we always imagine that space is inert, that there's nothing that's going on there. You know, it's mostly kind of an unreactive vacuum.
Right.
But in fact, I mean, there are cosmic rays, and there are huge amounts of energy being moved around in the universe.
It's a tough environment. Space is actually one thing you have to deal with is the thermal cycling. As we orbit the Earth every 90 minutes, we get 45 minutes when it's like 100 plus degrees centigrade, and then 45 minutes when it's minus 100. So orbiting the Earth, hot, cold, hot, cold. Any metal is going to expand, contract. So that's a tough environment, especially when you're going around the Earth 16 times a day, you know, and the space station's up there for 20 years or so. We also have to deal with micrometeorites, small particles traveling through space. It could be a small rock, it could be a grain of sand, but they're traveling at 28,000 kilometers an hour or more.
It can do huge damage.
A small particle like that can do significant damage. We also have radiation effects up there. So some solar radiation, some cosmic radiation that can affect your electronics. So it isn't this quiet, pristine vacuum of space that you think about. It's actually a challenging environment to be in.
It's terrifying.
It's a terrifying environment.
I mean, if you were out there and you didn't have a suit on, even if you could breathe, you wouldn't last very long.
Yeah, the radiation, just the sunlight, you know, there's no filtering of our sunlight by the atmosphere. You're receiving, you know, direct radiation, direct sunlight from it. So ultraviolet radiation levels are much higher for us up there.
Yeah, it would be the end of you very quick.
It'd be the end of you.
You know, so, how long do you think a human would last?
Without a spacesuit?
Yeah.
Even if you had oxygen, I don't know, just without the pressure containment, your organs are going to explode. It's not a pretty sight. So we always say, don't go outside without a spacesuit. That's a good rule of thumb.
Now, inside of these vessels that you take off from Earth at massive speeds and massive temperatures and massive pressures, and you can't take a lot with you. You have to be light as can be, right?
We carry a lot of experiments with us.
What's the payload?
The payload, the total weight would, you know, capability of the space shuttle was actually quite large. It could be 20,000 kilograms or so. So we were able to carry big pieces. We launched big satellites, parts of the International Space Station. But we try to minimize, you know, our weight for the crew on board.
Right.
Because sometimes if we have a massive satellite in the back, they want to minimize, you know, the food, the clothing, everything for the astronauts. So a few of my missions, we really had to cut back on what we were carrying up there from the perspective of the crew, just so we could carry our payload up to space.
Do they weigh you like 1,000 times before you go up there?
They actually do not do that. You think they would. You think they would, but they know our weight.
And what kind of food do you have up there?
The food is mainly freeze-dried food. So we don't have a refrigerator. We didn't have it on the space shuttle, so we can't take fresh food up there. And most of it is freeze-dried. It's fully cooked food. They freeze it, take away the moisture, and then that food will stay preserved in that state for years without any refrigeration. Once we get to space, we add hot water back to that food. It'll soften up. And then, you know, maybe after a few minutes after you add that water, it's almost edible again, I tell people. I use the phrase, I would never go to a restaurant that serves space food. So do not go up there for the food, but the view is spectacular. The mission, the experience is just breathtaking, but the food is just okay.
How many people go up at a time?
Three of my missions, we had a crew of 7 and one flight, 5. So it all varied on the shuttle, depending on what your task was up there.
And do they give you very specific job description?
Yeah, on each mission, you get assigned to a certain piece of that mission. So we have military pilots, 2 of them, that would fly the shuttle, and they're responsible for flying it. I'm not going to fly it. My job, I may be assigned to do a spacewalk, to go outside. I may be assigned to deploy a satellite. And once I get that assignment, that's what I focus on. And most of my training from that point on until we launch is just knowing my piece of the mission, and I have to know it very well. I have to be the best at that because my other crew members are depending on me and I depend on them for their skill level. So we break it down depending on, again, what the mission is and what your assignment is.
Are there civilians and military people?
It's a mix. Most of our pilots on the shuttle come out of the military. And I think in our astronaut office, we had 100 and some astronauts. I would guess 70, 75% of them came out of the military, and just 20, 25% were strict civilians.
Are you put through the most rigorous sort of testing and evaluation in order to get there? Because I would imagine there are so many people who want to go to space, first of all. Second of all, that they don't want to waste all of that money and that effort and that time and that energy on sending the wrong people up there. So they want to be as particular as possible.
The application process is pretty extensive. Thousands of people apply when they have an astronaut selection. And NASA would select new astronauts every 3 or 4 years. So thousands of people send in their application. They screen these down. And then NASA selects 100 individuals, and they bring you to Houston, Texas, to the Johnson Space Center. And you spend most of that week, you spend there doing a very thorough medical exam. So what they really want to know, are you in good shape medically? And then after that testing, there's a 1-hour interview. And based on that 1-hour interview, then you get selected or not. And it took me 4 tries going through that process. The first 3 times I was turned down. The 4th time I was successful and made it in there. And then once you get accepted into the program, there's a 1-year evaluation period. You're called an astronaut candidate.
Right.
And they shorten it in the astronaut office. We call these people ASCANs. And it kind of lets you know where you sit, where your position is socially within the astronaut office. But it's a year of evaluation and an initial training. And based on that, if you complete, you know, all the training, and almost everybody does at that point, then you go on and continue training and get assigned to a mission. So for me, it was, and typically it's 4 years or so.
Yeah.
When you walk in the door before you fly in your first mission, they've had many years to evaluate you. They're watching you in the simulators. They're watching you when you fly jets. They're watching you when you do everything. So anyway, any step along the way, if you misstep, then there's going to be question about, should we assign this person to a mission? So they're watching you carefully.
Yeah, it seems like there can't be a lot of jobs in the world that are more rigorous in terms of applications and success.
You know, probably medical school, law school, those are tough as well. But the astronaut one.
Smaller crew. I mean, smaller group of candidates.
It's a very small group of candidates. Like I said, thousands. And we had an astronaut selection just a year ago. 18,000 people applied.
Wow.
And they selected, I think, 9 or 10 new astronauts. So you have to have more than the minimum requirements. That's for sure. You have to try to distinguish yourself from everybody else applying. And I think in the end, you need a little bit of luck that day when you get selected.
Tell me, do you feel that when you look back at the history of space travel, and particularly in the U.S., how much government time and effort was put into the space program? You came along, your timing was really good because there was a huge emphasis on this stuff at the time. And there almost seems to have been a slight decrease in interest in the last maybe 10 to 15 years.
You know, I don't know if there's a decrease in interest in our space program. I had a great interest when I was a young boy.
Yeah.
And I go out to schools across the United States and around the world, even here in Johannesburg. Young learners, students are interested in space
but
exploration.
But I mean from the government point of view. And, you know, they're not putting as many craft into space as they used to.
You know, we don't have the funding that we used to have. NASA used to get 2 or 3% of the U.S. budget allocated for space exploration. Now we're under like closer to 0.5%. So the funding isn't there that we had during the Apollo program when we were landing astronauts on the moon. But I think universally, there's still a great support. Our citizens, you know, people in the United States support our space program. Our Congress, our, you know, politicians support it. You're competing with other agencies, you know, for housing, for the homeless, for education, and that makes it tough sometimes. But I think overall, space is still like a magical world, and it still captures the imagination of students young and old, and it still sees great support.
And of course, the things that we've discovered as a byproduct of our desire to get into space have been enormously useful to us.
Yeah, there's medical spinoffs, new technologies, new metals, materials that we've developed, computer technology, the miniaturization of our electronics, our cell phone technology. That all started early in the space program when you couldn't send a huge computer to the moon. You had to miniaturize everything.
Right.
So there's always great spinoffs. And for me, one of the greatest benefits of the space program, the greatest spinoff we call it, it can't be measured by dollars, but it's the inspiration that the space program provides for our young learners. It inspired me as a young boy to become an astronaut. So I worked hard in school every single day because I wanted to be an astronaut. I went on and got my university degree, bachelor degree in physics. I stayed in university and got my master's and doctorate. So today I feel like I pay a lot of taxes back to the government. It's been a good investment in me, and it all started with that inspiration of the space program. And our space program today still inspires young learners. We're doing that today in Joburg during our visit with Living Maths. We're visiting schools here. You see the spark in the eye of the young learners when you're telling them about how things float in space. So the inspirational component of space travel, I don't think it could be underestimated.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure you're right. And I'm thrilled that you're in South Africa to do this because I think a lot of people, their dreams hit a ceiling sometimes and it doesn't have to happen. It doesn't have to be that way. There is a world that you can be a part of if you really want to. And these days, of course, people are talking about, civilian space travel in terms of non-government funded spacecraft and kind of orbiting the Earth and being able to do things that we might not have, as a tourist, that we might not have been able to think about as private citizens before.
It's coming very, very soon. We have Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic. I would estimate he's going to be launching tourists to space within the next 2 years or so. Elon Musk with SpaceX, I don't know their projected dates, but he's just a few years from, again, sending people up commercially. So the opportunity is going to come. The price is coming down on this. You know, in the past, it's been millions of U.S. dollars to pay the Russians to go to space.
Right.
I would estimate it's going to come down into tens of thousands of dollars to go up and have the experience, like an exotic vacation to Antarctica.
Don, what does space do to your body?
It does a number of things. It's really amazing that you take away the parameter of gravity, just that one parameter in space, and so many things happen to the human body. You lose your muscle strength in space because we don't use our muscles up there very much. We also lose our bone density. Our bones get weaker in space. The one thing that makes your bones strong here on Earth is putting force on them. Weightlifters have the highest density bone of any athlete. And in space, there's zero force on your bones, so it doesn't stimulate them to grow, so your bones get weaker in space. We get exposed to more radiation in space. Some of our astronauts up on the space station who have been up there for 6 months and a year, they come back with vision problems, a little bit of macular degeneration, permanent vision loss. And many of the astronauts come back with some temporary vision changes because the shape of your eyeball changes in space.
They think again, that, because of gravity.
Because of the lack of gravity, there's a fluid shift. We have fluid as we stand here on Earth in our lower body that tends to shift upward when it doesn't have the pull of gravity pulling down. For the first day when you're in space, or first, you know, couple of days up there, you'll see your colleague astronauts, and it looks like they've been in a fight. Their face is a little puffy, swollen, and that's just from this fluid shift from your lower body up to your upper body. So many things happen. Our heart doesn't have to pump as hard, so your heart gets weaker up there like your other muscles do.
So how do you kind of get yourself back into shape when you're in space and when you get back to Earth?
Well, our astronauts up on the International Space Station, they exercise 2 to 3 hours a day up there.
Oh, wow.
That's a huge amount of exercise.
Sure.
And we've got a bicycle that they ride for aerobic activity. We've got a treadmill, which is good for aerobic, plus pounding of the bones, you know, putting a little bit of weight on them.
Right.
And then we've got resistive exercise devices, not free weights for lifting weights, but a system with pulleys and springs that the astronauts can lift weights, essentially, and put weight on those bones to stimulate them to grow. So our astronauts today actually are coming back in much better shape than they were 10 years ago. They're still dizzy, their muscles are weaker, their bones are a little weaker, but they're in much, much better shape than you would have seen 10 or 15 years ago.
What sort of a day do you have, you know, from morning till night in space? I mean, how do you start your day? What is the first thing you do? How hard is it to do ordinary stuff that we on Earth take for granted?
Yeah, the space shuttle was very busy. Our missions lasted about 2 weeks long or so. So they tried to pack in as much work as they could into those days. Space station, the astronauts are up there for 6 months. It's not as, you know, intense.
They get a little more time. Yeah.
So we compare it. The space shuttle was like a sprint, and the space station is more like a marathon. You can't run that fast. You got to keep going. But our space shuttle mission, you know, we work on a 24-hour day. They give us 7 or 8 hours to sleep at night.
Right.
We get up in the morning. They give us an hour to get up, have breakfast, brush your teeth, look at the plan.
How hard
for
is
the
it
day.
To brush your teeth?
Brushing your teeth is simple. Just take a toothbrush, toothpaste, brush your teeth. The one difference is we don't have a sink to spit into.
Right.
So our options are either to swallow the toothpaste and rinse your mouth out, or to spit it into a towel. But then you have a nasty towel to deal with. So most of the astronauts just swallow the toothpaste, rinse your mouth out. You know, you shave. Everything is very similar. It's a little harder without a sink. So I would take up an electric shaver, make that relatively easy. I wore contacts then, so I'd pop my contacts in. It was very easy to do in zero gravity. Then you review the plan for the day, your schedule, and then you're right at, you know, back at work. And we would work a number of hours, take an hour off for lunch. And our lunch break, you gather your food, you add the water to it, wait a few minutes, and then the crew would take our meals up in front of the window, and we would just watch the Earth go by and all share a meal together.
What is that like, to see the Earth from?
To see the Earth
a place that no human eyes have ever seen.
The most awesome sight that I think I've seen in my life.
How does it make you feel?
When I first got to space, my first mission, I had trained. I had seen movies of what the Earth was going to look like. Mm. I had seen many images of the Earth to study what I was going to be seeing up there. So when I launched, I thought, I know what this is going to be like, you know. But when I looked out the window, and this is the same for every astronaut, first mission, you look out that window that first time back at Earth, and you just gasp. It's like, oh, wow, look how incredible that is there.
And you think about the fact that there are probably, what, 7 or 5 of you on this craft, and down there is the rest of humanity.
Everybody else, billions of people down there. And the sky is a darker black color than I've ever seen anywhere else. I've been caving. We've shut off our lights. It is pitch black. But the sky in space is a darker black color. It's almost like a velvety, glowing black.
Wow.
And right up against that blackness is the Earth. And our thin layer of atmosphere glowing this like fluorescent blue. Just so spectacular to see that. And your eye can see more color variation and detail than any of the pictures that we take. And that is why you look out the window that first time, and it's just a huge gasp. And almost immediately, one of the thoughts I had was, wow, I wish my wife could be here. I wish my mom, my brothers, I wish my cousins. Yeah. Everybody, if everybody went to space and just looked out the window for 15 or 20 seconds, it does not take long. It will change your appreciation for our planet and how fragile it is, and it would make people motivated to take better care of this place.
I remember Buzz Aldrin saying that if everybody just got up there for a little while, they'd see how stupid all of our fights are, how all of our differences melt away, when we see, you know, how almost insignificant we are.
It's absolutely true. You know, part of it is we call the overview effect. When you're up there, you're seeing the whole planet, and it gives you a different perspective. As you mentioned, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Right.
And I used to identify myself as a Clevelander. People would say, where are you from? I'm from Cleveland.
Yeah.
Nowadays, when people ask me, where are you from? I'm more likely to say, I'm from Earth. And for me, it does not matter anymore what city you're from, what state, what country, what continent. It doesn't matter your religion or language. You know, we are more similar than we are different. And so some of these wars that we fight and other political differences, they seem silly to me. We're all Earthlings, number one. And it doesn't matter if we're in competing cities for some football team or anything else. It seems silly to me.
It's dumb, right? Don, what about the other stuff you can see? Is there other stuff that you can see when you're in space? Because we're so used to seeing everything through our atmosphere. And obviously the stars to us look very bright. But what does it look like beyond, if you're looking away from the Earth, if you're looking into the rest of our solar system, what can you see?
You know, looking at the night sky, the pitch black sky there at night, it is spectacular. It's as interesting for me as looking back at the Earth was, but our photos don't do it justice looking out at the black sky. So I saw more stars than I ever saw here on Earth, but not a billion times more. I thought I would see a billion times more, but I've been on top of mountains on a clear night, and you see the Milky Way shooting across the sky, and it was like that in space, except the sky was much, much darker. And you're looking out into infinity when you're up there, and there's nothing blocking your view, and it gets your mind thinking about how far am I actually looking, you know, into space, back in time, you know. Yeah, it was just awesome to see that. One of the interesting things I did see from space at nighttime was to see a shooting star.
Oh yeah.
And here on Earth, when we look for shooting stars, we look up at the sky. In space, when you want to see a shooting star, you have to look back at the Earth because we're actually up above the shooting stars. And that puts it in perspective again, where you're at and what are you doing when you look down below and the shooting stars are entering. They're probably entering 40 or 50 kilometers above the Earth, and we're 300 kilometers above.
Is it the kind of thing that when you go on a voyage like this, you want to go again almost as soon as you've landed, or have you had enough by that stage and, you know, it takes you a little while and you go, okay, I'm ready for the next one?
Part of my talk that I always give, I talk about the landing and what I was feeling at landing. And as soon as we landed on my first mission, I got out of the shuttle. I'm staring at it. I'm looking back at this vehicle thinking, what an amazing ship, you know, the space shuttle is.
Because you guys could land, the shuttle can land like a plane.
We land like a plane, yeah, right, so on a runway.
It's not like those guys used to have to drop down, you know.
Right, and in the ocean, splash down.
Yeah,
no, we land very precisely on a runway. And as I stood there gazing up at the space shuttle, one of the first thoughts that hit me was, I got to do this again. And I compare it to going on a great roller coaster at one of our theme parks. And sometimes you get off of it, you want to run around and get back in line and do it again immediately. And that's the way I felt. As soon as I landed on my first mission, it's like, wow, that was amazing.
Can you see out when you're doing reentry?
Yeah, you can see out the window during reentry.
What does it look like from the inside?
From the inside, you're looking out the front windows. You see for about a 15-minute period this pinkish red glow, like you're in the middle of a furnace, a blast furnace. Over my head, where I sat in my seat, there was a big window, maybe half a meter above my head or so. And I couldn't tilt my head up with the helmet on to look out that window, but I had a mirror on my knee.
Oh, yeah?
So I could look at my knee and use it as a rearview mirror, like in the car, to look out that window. And I would see huge flames, you know, coming off the shuttle. They would grow, you know, 5 meters, 10 meters, and then it would peel off, and then the new one would form, dance around, and peel off. So I'm looking above me at these huge flames. I look out the front window, and I see this pink-red glow, like you're in the middle of a fire. And I'm thinking, boy, out there it's like 2,000 degrees. I'm nice and safe in my spacesuit. So I never felt threatened. It was just a beautiful, beautiful light show. And all the astronauts, we would just marvel at the flames. It would almost gave a flashing appearance inside the cockpit, like somebody had a flash camera going off. There would be these discharges as the flames peeled off. But just spectacular, really beautiful, and very smooth ride coming in.
Not bumpy?
No, launch very bumpy. A lot of, you know, vibration and acceleration. The reentry, very smooth, very quiet. We are falling back to Earth. We have no engines. Like during launch, we're propelled up to space.
Right.
Coming back down, we are just falling, and it's very smooth. Every now and then, a little turbulence, but I've been on rougher commercial airline flights than I had on the shuttle. So, it, very smooth and quiet ride down.
Were you ever afraid in any of these missions that you undertook?
During launch, all four of my missions, there was a little piece of me that's afraid because this thing could blow up.
Yeah.
And we had Space Shuttle Challenger explode 90 seconds into the mission. All astronauts died on that. The vehicle was destroyed. So I think every astronaut in the back of your head, you have this little bit of fear, just, boy, I hope this works okay today.
Right. I mean, you're traveling in a big explosive. You've got huge amounts of liquid oxygen. It's just, I mean, that stuff catches fire.
You get liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen.
Liquid hydrogen, very explosive.
Millions of liters there. So, I mean, we are sitting on a bomb. And where I'm sitting in my seat, I'm just a few meters away from our big fuel tank. So if anything happens, you know, this whole thing is gonna go. So launch is always a little scary, mainly excitement, but a little piece of you in the back of your head is scared. On one of my missions, I had a scary moment. We had just done the engine burn, began our fall back to Earth, and one of the astronauts said, I smell smoke. And that's really bad in space. If we smell smoke here in the studio, we get outside. If you're cooking at home and the kitchen fills with smoke, we open the windows. We can't do that on the shuttle. If you have smoke, if you have a fire, you're stuck with that. And it probably couldn't come at a worse time than your reentry because we weren't going to be on the ground for another 50 minutes. So it was a terrifying moment to hear that phrase, I smell smoke. None of the other astronauts smelled it, and it seemed to go away for that individual. So in the end, nothing bad happened. I don't know what it was, but there was like about a 10 or 15 second period there where I thought,
sure,
this is bad. You know, I'm not sure we're going to make it back down. But we did. So there's a few scary moments.
It must be a very unique little club. I imagine that, a couple of hundred of you who've ever been to space?
About 550 people have flown to space over the last 55 years from all countries.
Do you get to meet these people? Do you all get together? You've got stuff to tell each other that no one else can really explain or experience.
You know, we have astronaut reunions for the NASA astronauts every couple of years in Houston. And then there's an association of space explorers, like a professional organization. They get together once a year. And so there's always, you know, you get together with your crew members, and there's always laughing going on when you remember some story of some event that happened, and lies that go on as you exaggerate things that happened as well.
And did you ever get to meet the guy you saw on TV, John Glenn, when you were a kid?
I got to meet John Glenn. I met Neil Armstrong. One of my greatest moments as a human being was the opportunity to meet him. I flew on space, up in space, 4 times. But again, the greatest moment of my life was I got to spend an hour with Neil Armstrong. I invited him to my launch, my third launch, and he wrote back and said I would be there because he was from the state of Ohio, and that's where I was. And I wrote him a letter saying, you know, you were one of my heroes as a young boy. You motivated me to follow my dream. And it was the day before launch, I got a telephone call from NASA management, and they said Mr. Armstrong wanted to meet with me. So I got to spend an hour one-on-one with him.
God, incredible.
And one of the greatest moments was I was saying goodbye to him at the end of the hour. I shook his hand and I said, hey, thank you so much for being here. I can't tell you how much it means to me. And I asked him how long he was going to stay in town, meaning how long are you going to stay in Florida for? And he looked me right back in the eye. He said, how long are you in town for? Meaning I'm going to stay here until you launch. And to have Neil Armstrong tell you that, it's like, wow, that was a great moment. We launched on time the next day. He went and met my wife and met my mom, you know, at the viewing site there. He was just such a great guy. So I got to meet Neil Armstrong, you know, John Glenn, Jim Lovell, many of the Apollo astronauts. I've met everybody who walked on the moon, you know, during my career. And I met many of the Russian cosmonauts as well. I lived over in Star City, Russia for 2 years. And I got to meet Alexei Leonov, the first human to do a spacewalk. I met Yuri Gagarin's wife and daughter when I was living over there. So that was also just an amazing opportunity to meet so many of the Russian cosmonauts.
What an incredible, incredible life. And you retired from NASA, what, only in 2007?
In 2007. So in the last 10 years, I've been doing educational work.
Mm.
And
tell me about what you're doing in South Africa. You mentioned this.
I'm working here with Living Maths, that's an NGO, and our mission is to get young learners, young students excited about math and science and engineering careers, and to show them, you know, this is fun. And part of my message is that to encourage young learners, young students, anybody, to never give up on their dream. You know, as a young boy, I had this dream of becoming an astronaut. It took me a while to get there. And I encourage the young learners, do not give up on your dream. They have dreams for their future. And many times we try a few things and fail and we give up and do something else. But my number one message for them is to never give up on your dream, because I almost gave up on mine when I was turned down that third time. I almost said, okay, forget this. This is too hard. They don't want me. But I really wanted to do it. So I learned, do not give up. But it is really, the program is to excite young students.
I'm so happy because, you know, we've got a problem getting people to study math, science, and engineering
around the world. It's not unique to South Africa. I travel to schools across the United States and around the world. This year I've been to...
Because people also think it's hard.
They think it's hard, and it is hard. You know, maths and science, it's a little harder than some of the other subjects. It was for me. But there is so much you can do with that. And there is so many amazingly great paying jobs, opportunities that are available there. The careers of the future are in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Well, I'm inspired already. And I know you didn't come here to see me, but I'm thrilled to meet you. And I'm delighted to hear your stories. And I could sit here and talk to you all morning, but I know you've got to launch some other missions across the country now. So thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's great to meet you. And keep inspiring these people.
We'll do it. My message is keep your eyes on the stars, which is to always keep your eye on your dream in life.
Beautiful. I love it. Thank you so much.
Very welcome.
Every now and then you get someone to pop by the studio who's done amazing things. And we've certainly met our fair share of amazing people. But this morning is kind of exciting for me because this is like every little boy's dream, and this guy has lived that dream, and he continues to to do amazing things in his life and with the stories that he has to tell. I'm talking about Dr. Donald Thomas, who is the former NASA astronaut, scientist, a professional speaker and educator and author, and he's in South Africa at the moment to regale us with all kinds of stories about what it's like to be in space. An actual astronaut. He's sitting right opposite me in his NASA uniform. Sir, it is a pleasure to see you.
It's great to be here today. Thanks for having me on.
Wow. I still can't get over the fact that you've spent, what is it, over 1,000 hours in space?
It's about almost 44 days in space during my four space shuttle missions. Yeah, orbited the Earth 692 times. So I had seen Joburg many times from space, but this is actually my first visit here, you know, down on the surface.
What an incredible thing to be able to say you've done.
It's pretty awesome. To fly around, fly in one space shuttle mission is incredible experience, and I had the opportunity to do it four times, so it's just mind-blowing.
You must be one of the people that they really relied on at the time if they put you up there four times, right?
They rely on all of us. I mean, there were 100 astronauts at the time, roughly, in the astronaut office there at NASA.
Did they cycle people?
And they cycle you through.
Okay. All right. So everybody gets a fair chance.
Everybody gets a fair chance.
If you're up there and you're doing good work, they keep you coming.
That's correct. If you don't do good work, you won't be going back up.
Now, you've written a book called Orbit of Discovery.
Correct.
Right. That's about your STS-70 mission, which is on board the Space Shuttle Discovery.
Right.
When we talk about these things, for many of us, it's stuff that we've seen in documentaries. It's perhaps stuff that we've seen in news footage. Maybe people have Googled a couple of pictures. But when you're in there and you're on there, that's the stuff I want to get into. That's the interesting information that I'd love you to convey to all of us. But you obviously grew up like any other kid with dreams of being, I don't know, a pilot at that stage, maybe?
When I was very young, when I was 6 years old, the first American launch into space. It was May 5th, 1961. And at my primary school, they brought all the learners to our gymnasium. I sat on the floor and I watched a small black and white TV of the launch that day. And as soon as our astronaut was in space, I remember sitting there just saying, I want to do that. I was hooked at that point.
Straight away.
And, you know, the next year, John Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth. They had us watch his launch as well, and I was hooked. So always throughout my life, this was my dream to go into space. It was a long path to get there. I was 39 when I ultimately made it to space. So it didn't happen quickly. It was a long-term dream, but I kept focused on it, and it kept me motivated and kept me inspired to keep working towards that goal.
And you were from Cleveland?
Grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, right, Northern United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long way from Cape Canaveral. That's a long way from Houston.
It is. And this is a curious fact, but more humans have flown in space from the city of Cleveland than any other location on the planet Earth. And there, our joke is, you know, what is it about Cleveland that makes you want to leave the planet?
You know? Now, you said it was a long journey. But it's also a fascinating one. I mean, you did everything. You were in the technical crew for a long time. You learned to fly then. You were at the Johnson Space Center as a materials engineer. I mean, all of those things on their own would be fascinating, and all of them on their own would be an incredible career, right?
Each one was fascinating for me. I worked at a company, AT&T Bell Laboratories, doing research work on electronic devices. I worked there for 6 years. Had two patents that I was able to get, but my goal was to become an astronaut. So, you know, I moved down to the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, worked there as an engineer on the space shuttle program, just trying to get closer to the action, hoping that it would help in the selection process for me to become an astronaut.
Now, I mean, being a materials engineer at the Johnson Space Center, you're at the cutting edge of so much of what was being discovered, what was being implemented, what was being tried for the first time. It must have been very exhilarating, but also kind of terrifying, because a decision that you make, or a test that you conduct, or a material that you're testing, these things can have massive ramifications. You know, especially when we look at things like Challenger and all of that stuff that was happening in the 80s. There were a lot of things that the engineers were responsible for that made it an incredibly difficult job.
It's a challenging job. One of my tasks at the Johnson Space Center as an engineer was to do some analysis to see whether our pressure vessels that they were designing for the space station, would they last for 20 years? You know, they were new materials, had never been tested before. We had used them for a year or two, but the question was, will they last 20 years? It was my job to do whatever I could to come up with an analysis to say, yes, they will last that long, or no, they won't. I gathered the data that I could find that had been published by other research, you know, organizations, and I put together a report, and I said, yeah, these things will last more than 20 years. It's been up there. The space station's been up there now for 17, 18 years, so I got two more years, and then I'll be able to say, okay.
I was right.
But I was confident that these materials will last. But that's the type of work you do. Even though sometimes we don't have all the data we need, we do projection analysis, and you kind of give your best engineering guess as to whether it's going to work or not.
When you talk about these materials lasting in space for 20 years, what are the major effects on a material in space? I mean, we always imagine that space is inert, that there's nothing that's going on there. You know, it's mostly kind of an unreactive vacuum.
Right.
But in fact, I mean, there are cosmic rays, and there are huge amounts of energy being moved around in the universe.
It's a tough environment. Space is actually one thing you have to deal with is the thermal cycling. As we orbit the Earth every 90 minutes, we get 45 minutes when it's like 100 plus degrees centigrade, and then 45 minutes when it's minus 100. So orbiting the Earth, hot, cold, any metal is going to expand, contract. So that's a tough environment, especially when you're going around the Earth 16 times a day.
Yeah.
You know, and the space station's up there for 20 years or so. We also have to deal with micrometeorites, small particles traveling through space. It could be a small rock, it could be a grain of sand, but they're traveling at 28,000 kilometers an hour or more.
It can do huge damage.
A small particle like that can do significant damage. We also have radiation effects up there. So some solar radiation, some cosmic radiation that can affect your electronics. So it isn't this quiet, pristine vacuum of space that you think about. It's actually a challenging environment to be in.
It's terrifying.
It's a terrifying environment.
I mean, if you were out there and you didn't have a suit on, even if you could breathe, you wouldn't last very long.
Yeah, the radiation, just the sunlight, you know, there's no filtering of our sunlight by the atmosphere. You're receiving, you know, direct radiation, direct sunlight from it. So ultraviolet radiation levels are much higher for us up there.
Yeah, it would be the end of you very
it'd
quick.
It'd be the end of you.
You know, so, how long do you think a human would last?
Without a spacesuit?
Yeah.
Even if you had oxygen, I don't know, just without the pressure containment, your organs are going to explode. It's not a pretty sight. So we always say, don't go outside without a spacesuit. That's a good rule of thumb.
Now, inside of these vessels that you take off from Earth at massive speeds and massive temperatures and massive pressures, and you can't take a lot with you. You have to be light as can be, right?
We carry a lot of experiments with us.
What's the payload?
The payload, the total weight, capability of the space shuttle was actually quite large. It could be 20,000 kilograms or so. Hmm. So we were able to carry big pieces. We launched big satellites, parts of the International Space Station. But we try to minimize, you know, our weight for the crew on board.
Right.
Because sometimes if we have a massive satellite in the back, they want to minimize, you know, the food, the clothing, everything for the astronauts. So a few of my missions, we really had to cut back on what we were carrying up there from the perspective of the crew, just so we could carry our payload up to space.
Do they weigh you like 1,000 times before you go up there?
They actually do not do that. You think they would. You think they would, but they know our weight.
And what kind of food do you have up there?
The food is mainly freeze-dried food. So we don't have a refrigerator. We didn't have it on the space shuttle, so we can't take fresh food up there. And most of it is freeze-dried. It's fully cooked food. They freeze it, take away the moisture, and then that food will stay preserved in that state for years without any refrigeration. Once we get to space, we add hot water back to that food. It'll soften up. And then, you know, maybe after a few minutes after you add that water, it's almost edible again, I tell people. I use the phrase, I would never go to a restaurant that serves space food. So do not go up there for the food, but the view is spectacular. The mission, the experience is just breathtaking, but the food is just okay.
How many people go up at a time?
Three of my missions, we had a crew of seven and one flight, five. So it all varied on the shuttle, depending on what your task was up there.
And do they give you very specific job description?
Yeah, on each mission, you get assigned to a certain piece of that mission. So we have military pilots, two of them, that would fly the shuttle, and they're responsible for flying it. I'm not going to fly it. My job, I may be assigned to do a spacewalk to go outside. I may be assigned to deploy a satellite. And once I get that assignment, that's what I focus on. And most of my training from that point on until we launch is just knowing my piece of the mission. And I have to know it very well. I have to be the best at that because my other crew members are depending on me and I depend on them for their skill level. So we break it down depending on, again, what the mission is and what your assignment is.
Are there civilians and military people?
It's a mix. Most of our pilots on the shuttle come out of the military. And I think in our astronaut office, we had 100 and some astronauts. I would guess 70, 75% of them came out of the military. Hmm. And just 20, 25% were strict civilians.
Are you put through the most rigorous sort of testing and evaluation in order to get there? Because I would imagine there are so many people who want to go to space, first of all. Second of all, that they don't want to waste all of that money and that effort and that time and that energy on sending the wrong people up there. So they want to be as particular as possible.
The application process is pretty extensive. Thousands of people apply when they have an astronaut selection. And NASA would select new astronauts every 3 or 4 years. So thousands of people send in their application. They screen these down. And then NASA selects 100 individuals, and they bring you to Houston, Texas, to the Johnson Space Center. And you spend most of that week, you spend there doing a very thorough medical exam. So what they really want to know, are you in good shape medically? And then after that testing, there's a one-hour interview. And based on that one-hour interview, then you get selected or not. And it took me four tries going through that process. The first three times I was turned down. The fourth time I was successful and made it in there. And then once you get accepted into the program, there's a one-year evaluation period. You're called an astronaut candidate.
Right.
And they shorten it in the astronaut office. We call these people ASCANs. And it kind of lets you know where you sit, where your position is socially within the astronaut office. But it's a year of evaluation and initial training. And based on that, if you complete, you know, all the training, and almost everybody does at that point, then you go on and continue training and get assigned to a mission. So for me, it was, and typically it's 4 years or so.
Yeah.
When you walk in the door before you fly in your first mission, they've had many years to evaluate you. They're watching you in the simulators. They're watching you when you fly jets. They're watching you when you do everything. So anyway, any step along the way, if you misstep, then there's going to be question about, should we assign this person to a mission? So they're watching you carefully.
Yeah, it seems like there can't be a lot of jobs in the world that are more rigorous in terms of applications and success.
You know, probably medical school, law school, those are tough as well. But the astronaut one.
Smaller crew. I mean, smaller group of candidates.
It's a very small group of candidates. Like I said, thousands. And we had an astronaut selection just a year ago. 18,000 people applied.
Wow.
And they selected, I think, 9 or 10 new astronauts. So you have to have more than the minimum requirements. That's for sure. You have to try to distinguish yourself from everybody else applying. And I think in the end, you need a little bit of luck that day when you get selected.
Tell me, do you feel that when you look back at the history of space travel, and particularly in the U.S., how much government time and effort was put into the space program? You came along, your timing was really good because there was a huge emphasis on this stuff at the time. And there almost seems to have been a slight decrease in interest in the last maybe 10 to 15 years.
You know, I don't know if there's a decrease in interest in our space program. I had a great interest when I was a young boy.
Yeah.
And I go out to schools across the United States and around the world, even here in Johannesburg. Young learners, students are interested in space, space
but
exploration.
But I mean from the government point of view. They're not putting as many craft into space as they used to.
You know, we don't have the funding that we used to have. NASA used to get 2 or 3% of the U.S. budget allocated for space exploration. Now we're under like closer to 0.5%. So the funding isn't there that we had during the Apollo program when we were landing astronauts on the moon. But I think universally there's still a great support. Our citizens, you know, people in the United States support our space program. Our Congress, our, you know, politicians support it. You're competing with other agencies, you know, for housing, for the homeless, for education, and that makes it tough sometimes. But I think overall, space is still like a magical world, and it still captures the imagination of students, young and old, and it still sees great support.
And of course, the things that we've discovered as a byproduct of our desire to get into space have been enormously useful to us.
Yeah, there's medical spin-offs, new technologies, new metals, materials that we've developed, computer technology, the miniaturization of our electronics, our cell phone technology. That all started early in the space program when you couldn't send a huge computer to the moon. You had to miniaturize everything. Right. So there's always great spin-offs. And for me, one of the greatest benefits of the space program, the greatest spin-off we call it, it can't be measured by dollars, but it's the inspiration that the space program provides for our young learners. It inspired me as a young boy to become an astronaut. So I worked hard in school every single day because I wanted to be an astronaut. I went on and got my university degree, bachelor degree in physics. I stayed in university and got my master's and doctorate. So today I feel like I pay a lot of taxes back to the government. It's been a good investment in me, and it all started with that inspiration of the space program. And our space program today still inspires young learners. We're doing that today in Joburg during our visit with Living Maths. We're visiting schools here. You see the spark in the eye of the young learners when you're telling them about how things float in space. So the inspirational component of space travel, I don't think it could be underestimated.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure you're right. And I'm thrilled that you're in South Africa to do this because I think a lot of people, their dreams hit a ceiling sometimes and it doesn't have to happen. It doesn't have to be that way. There is a world that you can be a part of if you really want to. And these days, of course, people are talking about, civilian space travel in terms of non-government funded spacecraft and kind of orbiting the Earth and being able to do things that we might not have, as a tourist, that we might not have been able to think about as private citizens before.
It's coming very, very soon. We have Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic. I would estimate he's going to be launching tourists to space within the next 2 years or so. Elon Musk with SpaceX, I don't know their projected dates, but he's just a few years from, again, sending people up commercially. So the opportunity is going to come. The price is coming down on this. In the past, it's been millions of U.S. dollars to pay the Russians to go to space.
Right.
I would estimate it's going to come down into tens of thousands of dollars to go up and have the experience, like an exotic vacation to Antarctica.
Don, what does space do to your body?
It does a number of things. It's really amazing that you take away the parameter of gravity, just that one parameter in space, and so many things happen to the human body. You lose your muscle strength in space because we don't use our muscles up there very much. We also lose our bone density. Our bones get weaker in space. The one thing that makes your bones strong here on Earth is putting force on them. Weightlifters have the highest density bone of any athlete. And in space, there's zero force on your bones, so it doesn't stimulate them to grow, so your bones get weaker in space. We get exposed to more radiation in space. Some of our astronauts up on the space station who have been up there for 6 months and a year, they come back with vision problems, a little bit of macular degeneration, permanent vision loss. And many of the astronauts come back with some temporary vision changes because the shape of your eyeball changes in space. They think
again that, because of gravity.
Because of the lack of gravity, there's a fluid shift. We have fluid as we stand here on Earth in our lower body that tends to shift upward when it doesn't have the pull of gravity pulling down. For the first day when you're in space, or first, you know, couple of days up there, you'll see your colleague astronauts, and it looks like they've been in a fight. Their face is a little puffy, swollen, and that's just from this fluid shift from your lower body up to your upper body. So many things happen. Our heart doesn't have to pump as hard, so your heart gets weaker up there like your other muscles do.
So how do you kind of get yourself back into shape when you're in space and when you get back to Earth?
Well, our astronauts up on the International Space Station, they exercise 2 to 3 hours a day up there.
Oh, wow.
That's a huge amount of exercise.
Sure.
And we've got a bicycle that they ride for aerobic activity. We've got a treadmill, which is good for aerobic, plus pounding of the bones, you know, putting a little bit of weight on them.
Right.
And then we've got resistive exercise devices, not free weights for lifting weights, but a system with pulleys and springs that the astronauts can lift weights, essentially, and put weight on those bones to stimulate them to grow. So our astronauts today actually are coming back in much better shape than they were 10 years ago. They're still dizzy. Their muscles are weaker. Their bones are a little weaker. But they're in much, much better shape than you would have seen 10 or 15 years ago.
What sort of a day do you have, you know, from morning till night? In space, I mean, how do you start your day? What is the first thing you do? How hard is it to do ordinary stuff that we on Earth take for granted?
Yeah, the space shuttle was very busy. Our missions lasted about 2 weeks long or so. So they tried to pack in as much work as they could into those days. Space station, our astronauts are up there for 6 months. It's not as, you know, intense.
They get a little more time.
So we compare it. The space shuttle was like a sprint. And the space station is more like a marathon. You can't run that fast. You got to keep going. But our space shuttle mission, you know, we work on a 24-hour day. They give us 7 or 8 hours to sleep at night.
Right.
We get up in the morning. They give us an hour to get up, have breakfast, brush your teeth, look at the plan.
How hard is it to brush your teeth?
Brushing your teeth is simple. Just take a toothbrush, toothpaste, brush your teeth. The one difference is we don't have a sink to spit into.
Right.
So our options are either to swallow the toothpaste and rinse your mouth out, or to spit it into a towel. But then you have a nasty towel to deal with. So most of the astronauts just swallow the toothpaste, rinse your mouth out. You shave. Everything is very similar. It's a little harder without a sink. So I would take up an electric shaver, make that relatively easy. I wore contacts then, so I'd pop my contacts in. It was very easy to do in zero gravity. Then you review the plan for the day, your schedule, and then you're back at work. And we would work a number of hours, take an hour off for lunch. And our lunch break, you gather your food, you add the water to it, wait a few minutes, and then the crew would take our meals up in front of the window, and we would just watch the Earth go by and all share a meal together.
What is that like to see the Earth from?
To see the Earth
a place that no human eyes have ever seen. The
most
Earth
awesome sight that I think I've seen in my life.
How does it make you feel?
When I first got to space, my first mission, I had trained. I had seen movies of what the Earth was going to look like. Mm. I had seen many images of the Earth to study what I was going to be seeing up there. So when I launched, I thought, I know what this is going to be like, you know. But when I looked out the window, and this is the same for every astronaut, first mission, you look out that window that first time back at Earth, and you just gasp. It's like, oh, wow, look how incredible that is there.
And you think about the fact that there are probably, seven or five of you on this craft, and down there is the rest of
everybody
humanity.
Else, billions of people down there. And the sky is a darker black color than I've ever seen anywhere else. I've been caving. We've shut off our lights. It is pitch black. But the sky in space is a darker black color. It's almost like a velvety, glowing black.
Wow.
And right up against that blackness is the Earth. And our thin layer of atmosphere glowing this like fluorescent blue. Just so spectacular to see that. And your eye can see more color variation and detail than any of the pictures that we take. And that is why you look out the window that first time, and it's just a huge gasp. And almost immediately, one of the thoughts I had was, wow, I wish my wife could be here. I wish my mom, my brothers, I wish my cousins. Yeah. Everybody, if everybody went to space and just looked out the window for 15 or 20 seconds, it does not take long. It will change your appreciation for our planet and how fragile it is. And it would make people motivated to take better care of this place.
I remember Buzz Aldrin saying that if everybody just got up there for a little while, they'd see how stupid all of our fights are, how all of our differences melt away when we see, you know, how almost insignificant we are.
It's absolutely true. You know, part of it is we call the overview effect. When you're up there, you're seeing the whole planet, and it gives you a different perspective. As you mentioned, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Right.
And I used to identify myself as a Clevelander. People would say, where are you from? I'm from Cleveland.
Yeah.
Nowadays, when people ask me, where are you from, I'm more likely to say, I'm from Earth. And for me, it does not matter anymore what city you're from, what state, what country, what continent. It doesn't matter your religion or language. You know, we are more similar than we are different. And so some of these wars that we fight and other political differences, they seem silly to me. We're all Earthlings, number one. And it doesn't matter if we're in competing cities for some football team or anything else. It seems silly to me.
It's dumb, right? Don, what about the other stuff you can see? Is there other stuff that you can see when you're in space? Because we're so used to seeing everything through our atmosphere. And obviously the stars to us look very bright. But what does it look like beyond, if you're looking away from the Earth, if you're looking into the rest of our solar system, what can you see?
You know, looking at the night sky, the pitch black sky there at night, it is spectacular. It's as interesting for me as looking back at the Earth was, but our photos don't do it justice looking out at the black sky. So I saw more stars than I ever saw here on Earth, but not a billion times more. I thought I would see a billion times more, but I've been on top of mountains on a clear night, and you see the Milky Way shooting across the sky, and it was like that in space, except the sky was much, much darker. And you're looking out into infinity when you're up there, and there's nothing blocking your view, and it gets your mind thinking about how far am I actually looking, you know, into space, back in time, you know. Yeah, it was just awesome to see that. One of the interesting things I did see from space at nighttime was to see a shooting star.
Oh yeah.
And here on Earth, when we look for shooting stars, we look up at the sky. In space, when you want to see a shooting star, you have to look back at the Earth because we're actually up above the shooting stars. And that puts it in perspective again, where you're at and what are you doing when you look down below and the shooting stars are entering. They're probably entering 40 or 50 kilometers above the Earth, and we're 300 kilometers above.
Is it the kind of thing that when you go on a voyage like this, you want to go again almost as soon as you've landed, or have you had enough by that stage and, you know, it takes you a little while and you go, okay, I'm ready for the next one?
Part of my talk that I always give, I talk about the landing and what I was feeling at landing. And as soon as we landed on my first mission, I got out of the shuttle. I'm staring at it. I'm looking back at this vehicle thinking, what an amazing ship, you know, the space shuttle is.
Because you guys could land, the shuttle can land like a plane.
We land like a plane on a runway.
It's not like those guys you used to have to drop down, you know.
Right, and in the ocean, splash down.
Yeah,
no, we land very precisely on a runway. And as I stood there gazing up at this space shuttle, one of the first thoughts that hit me was, I got to do this again. And I compare it to going on a great roller coaster at one of our theme parks. And sometimes you get off of it, you want to run around and get back in line and do it again immediately. And that's the way I felt. As soon as I landed on my first mission, it's like, wow, that was amazing.
Can you see out when you're doing reentry?
Yeah, you can see out the window during reentry.
What does it look like from the inside?
From the inside, you're looking out the front windows. You see for about a 15-minute period this pinkish red glow, like you're in the middle of a furnace, a blast furnace. Over my head, where I sat in my seat, there was a big window, maybe half a meter above my head or so. And I couldn't tilt my head up with the helmet on to look out that window, but I had a mirror on my knee.
Oh, yeah?
So I could look at my knee and use it as a rearview mirror, like in the car, to look out that window. And I would see huge flames, you know, coming off the shuttle. They would grow, you know, 5 meters, 10 meters, and then it would peel off, and then the new one would form, dance around, and peel off. So I'm looking above me at these huge flames. I look out the front window, and I see this pink-red glow, like you're in the middle of a fire. And I'm thinking, boy, out there it's like 2,000 degrees. I'm nice and safe in my spacesuit. So I never felt threatened. It was just a beautiful, beautiful light show. And all the astronauts, we would just marvel at the flames. It would almost gave a flashing appearance inside the cockpit, like somebody had a flash camera going off. There would be these discharges as the flames peeled off. But just spectacular, really beautiful. What? And very smooth ride coming in.
Oh, really? Not bumpy?
No, launch very bumpy. A lot of, you know, vibration and acceleration. The reentry, very smooth, very quiet. We are falling back to Earth. We have no engines. Like during launch, we're propelled up to space.
Right.
Coming back down, we are just falling, and it's very smooth. Every now and then, a little turbulence, but I've been on rougher commercial airline flights than I had on the shuttle. So very smooth and quiet ride down.
Were you ever afraid in any of these missions that you undertook?
During launch, all four of my missions, there was a little piece of me that's afraid because this thing could blow up.
Yeah.
And we had Space Shuttle Challenger explode 90 seconds into the mission. All astronauts died on that. The vehicle was destroyed. So I think every astronaut in the back of your head, you have this little bit of fear, just, boy, I hope this works okay today.
Right. I mean, you're traveling in a big explosive. You've got huge amounts of liquid oxygen. It's just, I mean, that stuff catches fire.
You've got liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen.
Liquid hydrogen, very explosive.
Millions of liters there. So, I mean, we are sitting on a bomb. And where I'm sitting in my seat, I'm just a few meters away from our big fuel tank. So if anything happens, you know, this whole thing is gonna go. So launch is always a little scary, mainly excitement, but a little piece of you in the back of your head is scared. On one of my missions, I had a scary moment. We had just done the engine burn, began our fall back to Earth, and one of the astronauts said, "I smell smoke." And that's really bad in space. If we smell smoke here in the studio, we get outside. If you're cooking at home and the kitchen fills with smoke, we open the windows. We can't do that on the shuttle. If you have smoke, if you have a fire, you're stuck with that. And it probably couldn't come at a worse time than your reentry, because we weren't going to be on the ground for another 50 minutes. So it was a terrifying moment to hear that phrase, "I smell smoke." None of the other astronauts smelled it, and it seemed to go away for that individual. So in the end, nothing bad happened. I don't know what it was, but there was like about a 10 or 15 second period there where I thought,
sure,
this is bad. You know, I'm not sure we're going to make it back down. But we did. So there's a few scary moments.
It must be a very unique little club. I imagine that, a couple of hundred of you who've ever been to space?
About 550 people have flown to space over the last 55 years from all countries.
Do you get to meet these people? Do you all get together? You've got stuff to tell each other that no one else can really explain or experience.
You know, we have astronaut reunions
for
the NASA astronauts every couple of years in Houston. And then there's an association of space explorers, like a professional organization. They get together once a year. And so there's always, you know, you get together with your crew members, and there's always laughing going on when you remember some story of some event that happened, and lies that go on as you exaggerate things that happened as well.
And did you ever get to meet the guy you saw on TV, John Glenn, when you were a kid?
I got to meet John Glenn. I met Neil Armstrong. One of my greatest moments as a human being was the opportunity to meet him. I flew up in space four times. But again, the greatest moment of my life was I got to spend an hour with Neil Armstrong. I invited him to my launch, my third launch, and he wrote back and said I would be there, because he was from the state of Ohio, and that's where I was. And I wrote him a letter saying, you know, you were one of my heroes as a young boy. You motivated me to follow my dream. And it was the day before launch, I got a telephone call from NASA management, and they said Mr. Armstrong wanted to meet with me. So I got to spend an hour one-on-one with him.
God, incredible.
And one of the greatest moments was I was saying goodbye to him at the end of the hour. I shook his hand, and I said, hey, thank you so much for being here. I can't tell you how much it means to me. And I asked him how long he was going to stay in town, meaning how long are you going to stay in Florida for? And he looked me right back in the eye. He said, how long are you in town for? Meaning, I'm going to stay here until you launch. And to have Neil Armstrong tell you that, it's like, wow, that was a great moment. We launched on time the next day. He went and met my wife and met my mom, you know, at the viewing site there. He was just such a great guy. So I got to meet Neil Armstrong, you know, John Glenn, Jim Lovell, many of the Apollo astronauts. I've met everybody who walked on the moon, wow, you know, during my career. And I met many of the Russian cosmonauts as well. I lived over in Star City, Russia for 2 years. And I got to meet Alexei Leonov, the first human to do a spacewalk. I met Yuri Gagarin's wife and daughter, oh, yeah, when I was living over there. So that was also just an amazing opportunity to meet so many of the Russian cosmonauts.
What an incredible, incredible life. And you retired from NASA, what, only in 2007?
In 2007. So in the last 10 years, I've been doing educational work.
Mm.
And
tell me about what you're doing in South Africa. You mentioned this.
I'm working here with Living Maths. Mm-hmm. That's an NGO. And our mission is to get young learners, young students excited about math and science and engineering careers, and to show them, you know, this is fun. And part of my message is that to encourage young learners, young students, anybody, to never give up on their dream. You know, as a young boy, I had this dream of becoming an astronaut. It took me a while to get there. And I encourage the young learners, do not give up on your dream. They have dreams for their future. And many times we try a few things and fail and we give up and do something else. But my number one message for them is to never give up on your dream, because I almost gave up on mine when I was turned down that third time. I almost said, okay, forget this. This is too hard. They don't want me. But I really wanted to do it. So I learned, do not give up. But it is really, the program is to excite young students.
I'm so happy because, you know, we've got a problem getting people to study math, science, and engineering
around the world. It's not unique to South Africa. I travel to schools across the United States and around the world. This year I've been to...
Because people also think it's hard.
They think it's hard, and it is hard. You know, maths and science, it's a little harder than some of the other subjects. It was for me. But there is so much you can do with that. And there is so many amazingly great paying jobs, opportunities that are available there. The careers of the future are in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Well, I'm inspired already. And I know you didn't come here to see me, but I'm thrilled to meet you. And I'm delighted to hear your stories. And I could sit here and talk to you all morning, but I know you've got to launch some other missions across the country now. So thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure.
Wow,
thank you very much.
It's great to meet you. And keep inspiring these people.
We'll do it. My message is keep your eyes on the stars, which is to always keep your eye on your dream in life.
Beautiful. I love it. Thank you so much.
Very welcome. CliffCentral.com.